morning, and welcome to Wanda's Picks, a Black Arts and Culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. Well, today, Friday, April 19th, the day before Mother Earth's birthday, we are going to let you listen to a couple of interviews from the archives before we shift into some interviews with some folks that are, you know, that it's current. I'm going to play first an excerpt of an interview that happened Wednesday, this past Wednesday, the 17th, which was actually the 41st anniversary of Albert Woodfox and Herman Wallace's incarceration at Angola State Prison, and they're still there, and they have been in solitary confinement all of that time. So that was a really sad anniversary this past Wednesday. However, on a more pleasant note, Keith Joseph Atkins' latest play, The Patron Saint of Plants, he joins us to talk about that, and I thought it'd be really appropriate because it's actually a look at the life of George Washington Carver. So we're going to play an excerpt of that, and then we're going to shift into another interview that was recorded live on the air in April of 2010, and it's with Camille T. Dungy. And she received a special recognition award for her book, Black Nature. She edited 4 centuries of African-American nature poetry. Really beautiful collection. And she is joined in the studio by Joyce Jenkins, who is the editor of Poetry Flash, one of the presenters of the Northern California Book Awards. And it's going to be the Northern California Book Awards, the 32nd annual Northern California Book Awards, is actually going to be taking place this year in May. May 19th, by the way, which is Malcolm X's birthday. So look for that. We're going to be probably having Joyce on and some of the other guests who are nominated for various categories for books written in 2012. And again, the Northern California Book Awards is going to happen at the San Francisco Main Library. If we don't run out of time, we are going to then play an interview with Rachel Rosin, who is director of programming for the San Francisco Film Society and filmmaker 360, and they are the presenters of the San Francisco International Film Festival, which, my goodness, is the oldest film festival in the United States, and it's 56 years old this year, and it starts April 25th, which is next week, and it goes until May 9th, and there are lots of great films that are of African and African-American interest, so we're going to talk about that. So it's going to be shifting from one interview into another, so stay tuned, and here we go. We're going to start again with Keith Joseph Atkins. And if you don't remember Keith Joseph Atkins, he is a writer and producer of the sci-fi thriller that's just really taken off on the web called The Abandon. And he's been on the air before to join us to talk about many of his wonderful plays. He comes here quite frequently. He's in New York now, and he was one of the writers for, what is the name of that sitcom? it was Tracy Ross was in it, and I cannot think of it. Oh, my goodness. Must be a little bit too early for me. So, you know, my Wednesday show is at 6 o'clock in the morning, so I was kind of sleepy this past Wednesday. But he wasn't, because he was in New York, and it's his play, and it was so wonderful. I had a reading at La Mama on Monday of this week. So, so here we are with you'll really enjoy this interview if you missed it. And if you want to catch all of it, I certainly suggest that you go online and listen to it. And it was, again, it was Wednesday, April 17th this year, that it was broadcast in entirety, in its entirety.
Heavy sweet orange made the branch bow low, 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 low. Well, once in my eye, I form on high. When it is ready for hungry hands, it kept on you. Halo grows and power swells. You are seduced by its call. Oh yeah, its call.
Black Arts and Culture Program of the African Sisters Media Network. And we are listening to Maclete Hadaro from her debut CD, A Day Like Today. She's singing Call. And we're joined in the studio by one of our favorite playwrights and writers, Keith Joseph Atkins, and he has a new play that just had a debut reading on Monday in New York at a really famous theater, and he's going to tell us all about it. Good morning, Keith. How are you?
Good morning, Wanda. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm sleepy. I was up almost half the night trying to read this play. I got... Yeah, I didn't finish it. I got to like 48, page 48. So you're going to have to tell us about it. But I just thought it was so cool that, you know, you wrote this wonderful play about George Washington Carver, but the patron saint of plants is a George Washington Carver we might not know, because it's about,
right,
you know, him as a little boy and about his family and his yearning for education and this belief in God, and it's just really beautiful.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. I really appreciate that.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, you know, originally I was commissioned to write the play from a theater called Alabama Shakespeare Festival in Montgomery, Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
And they were interested in a play about George Washington Carver. And so they approached me. This was several years ago, actually. They approached me about it. And I was a little, you know, hesitant because I didn't know much about George Washington Carver outside of the Peanut fame and him being a scientist. And I didn't, you know, and so all the pictures, he looks like a very, you know, sweet and gentle old man, you know, that whole sort of image, romanticized image of him. And so I was like, well, I don't know what I can do. I mean, you know, I was like, to dramatize his life, you know, I don't know what to do with him. And they said, well, you know, if you just think about it, if you come down and, you know, we'll fly you down and, you know, there's a George Washington Carver Memorial Museum on the Tuskegee's campus,
mm-hmm.
and you can sort of see, you know, and hear and all that. And so anyway, I went down to the museum at Tuskegee. And I walked in, and it's full-out, amazing museum just in honor and in dedication of him. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, there's pictures. There are paintings that he crafted. There are, you know, his polio sort of experimentations of how to end polio through, you know, sweet potato, and just all these different things that I didn't really know. I mean, I knew he was a scientist, but I didn't know it was that. Just out of my own ignorance and just out of my own sort of laziness about, you know, certain parts of Black history when I was younger. So I didn't know what to expect. So what was the really fascinating thing was I walked in, and there was this recorded sort of tour guide voice that you heard that was sort of talking about science and peanuts and things like that. And so I went to the person behind the counter, the park ranger, and asked, whose voice was that talking? And she said, "That's George Washington Carver's voice."
Wow.
And I said, "But it sounds like a woman." And she said, "Yes." I said, "He sounded like that." Like it kind of shocked me. Mm-hmm. His voice was very soft, and not to associate that women have soft voices, but you know, your original sort of reactions like, oh, that's a woman's voice, is it soft or it's sort of high pitched? And so I thought it was a woman or a child. Mm-hmm. And so she said, no, it's George Washington Carver, and his voice sounded like that. And you know, there's speculation that he possibly was castrated, which would inform his voice. And I was like, what? Mm-hmm. And as soon as she said that, I was like, oh, I have a play.
I was wondering, you know, like your play is really dramatic. When we first meet him, there's a big, well, not when we first meet him, but very soon there's this big storm coming, and when he leaves home, I should say, and the person, that's after that play. I mean, it's like three, there's like so much happening. But he
right.
witnesses a lynching. And I said, oh, that's when he got castrated, when he was a little boy. And it's like, no, he escaped. So I'm like, oh, okay. So I'm thinking maybe that was a myth. So
right.
did you find out, was he really castrated? Did you find that out?
I didn't really find that out. I mean, there was a lot of, in my research, there was a lot of speculation about potential castration, but it didn't make sense to me though if he was castrated that it happened as a child, because he obviously became an adult and he had a beard, and usually I think secondary characteristics are absent when you were castrated prior to puberty.
Okay.
So it's like, well, whatever happened, it didn't happen when he was a child.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I was actually at Tuskegee, I met a young woman whose mother was a nurse at Tuskegee Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And without having any connection to what I was doing or any, knowing about a play being written, she said that her mother saw his autopsy reports that indicated that he was castrated.
Oh, she did?
So that's the closest that I got to sort of feeling like there's some truth to that sort of myth, whether or not it was castration or something, some type of physical something happened to him. And I do believe that. I'm not sure if it was castration, but there was something that happened. Yeah, it could have been medical, right. But my interest in it, in sort of that part of the story and then just his life in general, so what I discovered in my research was that, one, he was an amazingly spiritual person, started off as a Christian, and then morphed and expanded into Deism and the Baha'i and Sikhism.
Really?
Just world religions. Yeah, he was an advocate for just God being central. And eventually he stopped calling God God and started calling God the Creator.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that.
I was just thinking about, you know, when he is talking to Professor Pamel, and I'm trying to think what university is that?
That was at Iowa State.
Right, Iowa State. He says to him that the God is not just the God of the Christians.
Right.
and he mentions these other religions that you said he eventually embraced. So
mm-hmm.
it's kind of interesting. So were you doing some foreshadowing there for us?
Yeah, maybe it was, yeah. But, you know, I was really, you know, I was really moved, you know, in my research by his spiritual quest and his spiritual curiosity, which you usually don't associate with, you know, late 19th century and early 20th century Americans, period, and particularly you don't associate that with black people. You know, we're usually associated with sort of a monolithic Christian narrative and not talking about world religions in the late 19th century. And so that really fascinated me. And also his, you know, his deep, deep love of plant life and how he found and created a language, a spiritual language when he talked about plants, which actually made him, in my research, I discovered that that gave him a lot of notoriety, both sort of in a national sense as far as like his conversations with John Rockefeller and William Howard Taft and I think it was Henry Ford. Like his conversations with them about science was God-based. And so even his lectures at Tuskegee, from what I understand, in my research and interviews, because I actually interviewed a woman when I was there several years ago at Tuskegee, who was, I think, 90 at the time, and she remembered him.
And he was her teacher?
He wasn't her teacher, but his notoriety on campus was, like, wide. And he was particularly noted for his lectures, that his lectures were overcrowded every time he lectured, and that they had a spiritual component to them, which is why she believed they were so popular, and that his lectures were more attended, had more attendance than actual the chapel on Sunday on campus.
Wow.
Because he was talking about God and science.
Nice.
And and talking about the God life within every student, and you know, having them think about their own godliness. I mean, he was pretty fascinating. Now, so for me, it was like his love of plant life and his you know, creating that language, that God language and spiritual language around plant life and around science, also made me curious about, as far as me writing the play and sort of this the journey that he goes on, because he's very much interested also in plant grafting, which was, you know, combining the plants and creating, like, you know, these particular distinctive specimens out of two or three different types of plants. Like, he was, as a child, interested in grafting and interested in putting things together and creating a new identity. And so that, to me, was, you know, the creative fuel I needed to create the story I wanted to tell about him as far as his own personal life. Like, his personal life was a reflection of his scientific life, that as a scientist, he was trying to graft and put different parts together that didn't seem to be together to create this one thing, and I thought he was doing the same thing for himself. And so for me, the castration myth made much more sense. That's why I thought that something did happen, and maybe, you know, in my own creative imagination and sort of trying to bear witness to him, it seemed likely that maybe he was trying to graft himself in some way to create this other thing.
How cool. What a hypothesis.
And that, to me, makes more sense as this sort of just mundane, I'm castrated. Like, it makes more sense that maybe he was trying to create this other being of himself that was much more godly as opposed to earthly. Because later on...
Go ahead.
And so later on, when he was at Tuskegee, and you know, he was, you know, I don't know how many people know this about him and his experience at Tuskegee, but he had a very difficult time there. And
did he? I thought he had a great time there. Really?
Oh, they gave him a hard time. He actually resigned 7 times.
Oh, who gave him a hard time?
The faculty.
Oh, why?
I think there are many reasons. I mean, there are a couple of them that I explore and sort of improvise on, but what makes sense to me is, one, and this is documented, it's not anything that I'm making up, like, there was a lot of animosity toward him from some of the faculty members, but one thing, most of the faculty at Tuskegee at the time of George's arrival were Hampton alums. And they also had come from, many of them, not all of them, but many of them had come from either favored slave descendancy, where, you know, their fathers or grandfathers or mothers or grandmothers had been children of slave owners and have been privileged in some sense, and sort of in the slave community had some type of privilege or favor. And so I think they were bringing that type of culture to Tuskegee. And then you also had Hampton, which is also, you know, a signifier of sort of black royalty or intellectualism. And so then you had George, who was much darker, who did not come from that favored slave experience. He was actually raised by a white couple, not as, even though his mother had been this couple's slave, they raised him as their own son in their own house.
Mm-hmm.
So he had basically come up as a white boy, and,
right.
You know, even though he's, mm-hmm. right. And so, because he was living in the Ozarks, so there weren't a lot of black families around the area he grew up in, even though he knew of them, but he didn't have direct access to him until he got a little older.
Mm-hmm.
And he left. He had to, leave, yeah, to find education because there wasn't any in that community. And so I think he brought that sensibility with him to Tuskegee as well as, you know, after he left Missouri, he, you know, traveled throughout Kansas and then Iowa for education and just sort of personal living. And so his personal living prior to Tuskegee was white. He lived in white communities,
mm-hmm.
Socialized, frolicked with white people.
White people fell in love with him too.
And fell in love with him. I mean, in my research, I read so many letters that people wrote to him, from people who literally met him one day to people who knew him for 3 years, and they were all equally impassioned, equally, you know, just revered him. But he literally changed their life. Like, people literally just met him a day and wrote to him for the rest of their lives.
Wow.
And
because, you know, your character, Mrs. Love, I mean, you see what happened to her. You know, she had lost her son and her husband. And he saw, what did he say he saw in her face?
She had a tired soul.
Yeah. And she was picking something, and her hand was hurt, and he broke off a piece of a plant. It seemed like it might have been aloe vera, and rubbed it on her hand, and it made it feel better. And she just, like, wow, this plant's been here all this time. Why did it decide all of a sudden, like, you know, to help me, you know, heal my hand? And he had this, your writing is just so great, you know, with the words you had come out of his mouth, the character's mouth, were just so lovely.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah, and then they, you know, he met a kindred soul. I mean, you know, they prayed together, and you have him singing all the time. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know he sang. Until I read your play.
right. Well, apparently he sang in 8 octaves.
Wow, that's a lot.
Yeah.
Wow.
In a, you know,
how many octaves do we have with regards to range?
It's about 8. I think it's about 8.
He's got the whole orchestra in his voice, huh? Wow, that's awesome.
he sang pretty amazingly from what I understand and from what I read.
Mm-hmm.
And also he played piano, and
wow.
He was self-taught, and he played the banjo, and he played the guitar, he played the accordion.
Wow.
And he, you know, as we do know, he was a painter, he's a visual artist,
mm-hmm.
Which is what his original educational pursuit was, art. He,
mm-hmm.
Although his journey had been the collection of science, sort of, you know, a deep relationship with science and nature. When he enrolled at Simpson College in Indianola, I think it was Indianola, Iowa. He enrolled as an art student,
mm-hmm.
and a piano student. So he was attending this college, this liberal arts college, that Simpson College, where he was in classrooms with the majority of white women studying visual art and piano. He's the only black male there, the only black person there. and he one of his main sort of visual staples was the yucca plant.
Right. Yeah, he talked about the yucca almost as if it was a person.
Right.
How
right.
you know how it inspired him, how it gave him strength. Talk about
right.
the yucca plant for my audience who might not be familiar with that particular plant.
Well, yeah, I mean, from what
it's
I
a root
from what
plant,
I understand,
isn't it?
Yeah, it's a root plant, but it's also it's a cactus. I guess we consider that a succulent.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean the yucca in the prairie, which is where he discovered them and had access to them, are succulent, and I believe I'll just say cactus like. That's what I'll
mm-hmm.
say about it. And it has it has sort of standard base. And then these amazing white blossoms that come out of the top of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite beautiful, you know, when it's in bloom. And apparently the Native Americans used it to make soap. So it has like a medicinal quality and a medicinal use as well. And it's sort of domestic. Now, I do know that my understanding, his relationship it was that it was so sturdy. It was such a sturdy plant, and it survived everything. It was always standing. And then even with, you know, no matter what happened, whatever the weather was, whatever the temperature was, it still was there, and then it still was able to create these amazing blooms. And so I think that he may have saw himself in that, or at least aspired to be this plant. That didn't need much to sustain itself, and it still provided beauty.
Hmm. Nice. Yeah.
What his life was like.
Mhm. Yeah, certainly. So his brother visits him after he dies. You have him having visions, and you know, sort of being
yeah.
like a prophet almost.
Yeah. Well, you know, what was interesting, you know, in my research, I did a lot of reading in between the lines. I mean, a lot of times, I was reading letters that people wrote or letters that he wrote to other people. And so some things were not written out as if this is documented information about, like, George Washington Carver saw ghosts. It wasn't anything like that. It was just reading what he was talking about. And I remember in one of the letters that he wrote to someone, he was talking about the visitation of his brother.
Mm-hmm.
His brother visited him. I think he was counseling a friend who had lost someone, and he was saying that don't fret, that, you know, if you're open, that person will visit you.
Mm.
So I was like, oh, this man believed in, you know, the other wall, that there's other things on the other side of the wall that actually came through.
Mm-hmm.
But he was connected to that as well, which didn't surprise me. If he was having that type of meditative experience with plant life,
mm-hmm.
and that God existed in that meditation, that of course he would be open to the spiritual world that we don't always realize is there, that's in communication with us.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, and so for me, like, his brother dies of smallpox in real, you know, in truth, he did,
mm-hmm.
and that it made sense that his brother would visit him and that he actually would be in conversation with his brother and that they would be in some, would have some sort of pursuit, like, you know, in the play, as you know, they're looking for, or his brother's encouraging George to look for their mother, who
right.
may have not abandoned him when he was an infant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's really interesting, what his brother tells him about their fathers and
right.
and their mother. That's really interesting, 'cause
yeah.
you know, the Hampton alumni, and you know, George was right there with him. I mean, you know, he
right.
was, he was raised, if you know, being connected to, you know, white lineage or European lineage, it makes you better than other people. Well, George was right there. He was in their house.
Oh, yeah.
And his brother
oh, yeah.
had a father that was white.
Right.
And he
right.
raised the two boys. So
both of them. Yeah.
How close can you
yeah.
get, right?
Right. And
if that's
and I think
a big
that,
deal.
I mean, exactly. And I think that for George, that ultimately was because what was interesting in George's journey, particularly when he got to Tuskegee, he remained humble, but I feel like because he was in constantly defending himself at Tuskegee in those earlier years, that he started to sort of use his story as a defense. So, you know, yes, you guys may be favored slaves or your grandfathers and all that, but you were still living in the shack. I actually was living in the house. You know, that's what I got.
Okay, so George, I'm like, okay,
you know,
whatever. It's like, I'm going to just flash on y'all.
right.
Okay.
And, but, you know, even the story around the story that, you know, we all know, the historical story about George Washington Carver is that his mother and he were kidnapped by slave raiders, you know, in the Ozark in, you know, around 1865, 1864, and then taken away, I think, maybe to either Oklahoma or somewhere, Arkansas, I believe it was. And then George's owner, Moses Carver, set out, you know, hired someone to go and find, you know, George and his mother. And then this man went and looked and, you know, and traded a horse and wasn't able to bring George's mother back, but brought George back as an infant, and had some, George was sickly when he arrived back at the Carver home, and then Moses Carver and his wife Susan raised George, right? So for me, because I already do genealogy and I already, you know, have a fascination with history, I started to sort of question that story, because I was like, well, why are slave raiders coming to a part of the country where there's so few slaves?
Mm-hmm.
Like, we're talking about the Ozarks. We're not talking about, you know, the Virginia frontier. We're talking about the Ozarks, where, one, there's poor white folks. And it, even when I sort of went through the census record, very, very few of those families had slaves. And if they had them, it was one, maybe two. And but that was even few and far between. So it didn't make sense to me, just sort of economically, or even logically, that slave raiders would come rolling through the Ozarks looking for slaves to kidnap. Do you know what I mean? So I was like, there's something weird here. And so it made more sense to me in my storytelling to actually think about her running away, which makes more sense. With her child,
right,
and then the fact that Moses seeks her out and sends someone when he doesn't have a lot of money himself, and he's hiring somebody to go and get this young woman with this baby. It just all was kind of like loose info for me. And what made more sense economically and politically was that she had run away,
yeah,
and to get her back. Was an issue because she had run away, not stolen.
Mm-hmm.
So in my storytelling, in the play, you know, I deal much more with her being the idea of her running away, and that even in my research, I was reading, you know, because several people have different things to say about him and different scenarios. And one scenario that was very interesting was that someone believed that his father actually was an enslaved black man on a farm nearby, which I think maybe was like 10 to 15 miles away, and the only other, George's father was the only other black man, enslaved black man in the area that would make sense, that would be his father, and that man was actually killed by a cart, was run over by a cart. And so in my research, someone actually alludes to the fact that someone killed him and that Moses Carver may have killed him.
Mm-hmm. Right. Wow, really fascinating. So everyone is really curious, I'm sure, with how George Washington Carver met Booker T. Washington. How did they connect? How did he end up at Tuskegee and do all of that great work?
Right. Well, you know, what I discovered was that George was on a ride to celebrity while he was at Iowa State College in Ames, Iowa. And he, you know, was the first black student. I mean, after he, you know, he was at Simpson College, you know, as a visual arts student, and then his visual art instructor, because he was so invested in botany, thought he should actually be a botanist because that would make much more sense for a man, which is what this woman was thinking for him. So he goes there, and he's the only black student there, and he does amazingly, of course, and then sort of branches out into dramatic art and, you know, all of it, just grafting and hybrid planting and all of that stuff. He does amazing things with plum trees. And so then he eventually was, after graduating, he got his master's degree at Iowa State, and then they made him a faculty member. So he's the first black student, the first graduate black student, and then the first black faculty member at Iowa State. So then the word got out that he was this amazing plant grafter, and that he was doing this amazing stuff with fungus and then hybrids. And the hybrids, of course, is like, you know, grafting, putting two things together to make one, and cross-pollinization. So that was his thing. And so he was asked to speak on at several different conventions and symposiums around science in the D.C. area, in Washington, D.C. One sort of major event in his life was where he was asked to go to a science convention, I think in Lake Geneva, New York. And he took several different high-ranking white folk, and I'm thinking like Andrew Carnegie, John D. Rockefeller, on this nature tour. And apparently whatever he said on that tour rocked their world. Mm. And he became their favorite person. So meanwhile, Tuskegee, Booker T was working as hard as he could trying to bring Tuskegee to a national attention and hoping that Tuskegee would be the agricultural backbone of America. He wanted, you know, so-called Negroes at the time to be what America sought after for agriculture support and agriculture, period, which is a great plan, you know. And so he felt like George Washington Carver, because he was a black man and because of his notoriety already nationally, it would make sense for Tuskegee that George would be there. And so he offered George to run his agriculture department, and George wasn't quite convinced at first it was the right thing to do because he was such at home at Iowa. Even though he had problems there, you know, folks spit at him, they didn't want him, he couldn't sleep in the dorm, he had to sleep, you know, in the basement for a while, you know, all that kind of stuff. They'd gone through a lot of different racial obstacles, but ultimately found peace there. In science, and the science community, the science faculty loved him. And so he was a little resistant, but ultimately he remembered a woman from his past who said that the most important thing to do with your education is to give back to your own people. And so when Booker T invited him, he thought that was a sign from God to do exactly that, to give back to his people. And so that's why he went to see. And the interesting thing about that relationship between Booker T and George was that Booker T was, as we know, and many probably don't know, that he was, you know, he was a full force brute. I mean, he was serious, you know, a politician and all, you know, and all the ups and downs of that. And I guess he had to be because, you know, he was running this major institution and he wanted it to be a staple in America. And so yet he also was a lover of Shakespeare, which for George was an end because George loved drama.
Mm-hmm.
And they shared that together. They shared quoting Shakespeare and Othello. And Booker T, you know, made it very clear that he respected and was and admired George's nature, spiritual sort of philosophy. And encouraged it and gave him space. In fact, when he got to the city, Booker T was paying George $1,000 a month, which was more than half of what the other faculty members are being paid, who have families and children, which started
wow.
some of the animosity from the start.
Oh, that they knew he made a lot more than them?
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And so, but George, I think, George, and my, you know, it's sort of, it, you know, from what I got from the research and just sort of reading in between the lines, and also just sort of understanding George and understanding Booker T, I think that George felt that he had a spiritual obligation to be at Tuskegee. He was so invested in helping the farmers, the local black farmers, mm-hmm. in improving their livelihoods and doing things at cheaper costs, which is why he got really invested in sweet potato, because the sweet potato could be used in several different ways. He discovered that, you know, you can use it as flour, you could use the compost as fertilizer. You know, he just got really inventive and creative, and that community that was poor really needed him, and he knew that, and that's what he wanted spiritually to do. And he didn't even care about the money. And he was getting all kind of awards and, you know, wouldn't even go to the events because he wasn't that invested in the accolades. But I do know that he loved Booker T. Washington. And I know that, you know, he had dinner with them every Sunday. And I know that because Booker T.'s daughter, Portia Washington, has an autobiography, which I read. And Portia Washington grew up, you know, with George and, you know, at those dinners and seeing him with her father all the time. And then she, of course, grew up and you know, moved to Europe and had a bohemian life. And I think she sang and, you know, sort of part of that crowd, the black expatriate crowd of early Europe. And she wrote in her autobiography that George was in love with her father. That as a child, she didn't know what that was, but as an adult, she now could identify it. Mm-hmm. And so for me, that helped me understand his entire journey, but also it sort of forced me to think about what in love for her would mean for George,
mm-hmm.
because he was so invested in the sort of naturalness of everything that I think there was something that he felt that was divine about his relationship with Booker T, that it was something much bigger than what was mundane.
Mm-hmm.
That whatever that love was, it was like, I'm helping the world change, and this man is allowing me to help him do that.
Hmm. Wow. Oh, how fascinating. Well, your journey, well, that's just part of the wonderful conversation that I had with Keith Joseph Atkins, and if you want to hear the rest of it, you need to go into the archives and look it up. It gets better and better. And Keith Joseph Atkins, again, is the writer and producer of The Abandoned, a sci-fi sitcom about some black men doing some paranormal things, and it's really fascinating. It's got a great following, and he talks about that a little bit in the interview. And he is known for, as the writer on the Girlfriends sitcom. That was the that was the show that I couldn't think of a little bit earlier. I'm going to let you know about a couple of things that are happening in the San Francisco Bay Area, and for Earth Day weekend. Tomorrow, Saturday, Earth Day, there is a community cleanup and volunteer day in San Francisco. And there's Cal Day, where UC Berkeley is open for the whole day, and there are activities for the family and young people to just get familiar with that campus. So that's really fun. There's free Afro-Peruvian dance class at the Bayview Opera House. The Oakland Earth Day Volunteer Day for cleanup is also on Saturday, tomorrow. The Exploratorium just opened in a new facility on Embarcadero at, I believe, I'm not sure what pier it is. I'm not sure if it's Pier 23, but you can't miss it. So that's really fun. There's going to be an Earth Day Festival and Civic Center at 10 o'clock, and it's going to go all day. There's Earth Day on the Bay in Redwood City, and that's going to be nice. And then over, there's also going to be a Cesar Chavez Holiday Festival in the Mission District, and that's going to be all day as well. That's going to be really nice. The Cherry Blossom Festival in Japantown in San Francisco continues this weekend, Saturday and Sunday. And there's going to be Earth Day Yoga and Dance Flash Mob in Civic Center as well. Let's see, the 5th Annual Living Green Living Festival is begins at 1 o'clock in Gillardelli Square. There's going to be, sounds really fun, on Sunday, there's going to be a disco skating festival concert. That sounds really nice. That's going to be on Sunday in Golden Gate Park. What else is happening? Let's see. The California Academy of Sciences is having these free days for different neighborhoods beginning tomorrow. There's a Earth Day Festival, free popsicles, and yoga in Jack London Square on Sunday in Oakland, California, in Jack London Square. Let's see. There's going to be the 2nd Annual Real Food Neighborhood Earth Day Festival on Sunday at 10 o'clock. Oh, no, 11 o'clock. Let's see. Just reading down this list. On Monday there's going to be the meteor shower that you can catch early morning. So I'm just reading from the Leonid's meteor shower, and that's really early morning, 4:19 in the morning, and so don't want to miss that. That is so beautiful. It actually is between April 16th and the 25th, but it's going to peak before dawn on the 22nd, when about 10 to 20 meteors are expected per hour. So that's going to be really cool. And then there, the waxing Gibbons moon lights up the nighttime until the wee hours of the morning. So that's going to be really lovely. So I am reading from the I get this really useful list of all these activities from Fun Cheeps, and you can subscribe too. I also noticed that Sela is going to be giving a concert. Sela, who is really known for his Afro-funk band, he's from Kenya. They're going to be having a concert, and he's kicking it off in Civic Center on Sunday, and that's a free concert. So I put a link to this in the description for today's show. So just go to the website and click on it, and you can also find out about all these activities. So we're going to play this other interview that I mentioned featuring editor Camille T. Dungy, whose book Black Nature, 4 Centuries of African-American Nature Poetry, got a special recognition 3 years ago at the Northern California Book Awards. So here is that, and then we're going to shift into the interview I mentioned with Judy Juanita. So just a second, and I'm going to find that interview, and I'm going to play that. And you're going to hear, because also in that interview, before Camille and Joyce Jenkins joined me, we were talking to Dr. Alberta Rose, and if you remember, 3 years ago in April, she retired from her tenure at San Francisco State University in the dance department, and there was a big, wonderful concert featuring her choreography in honor of her retirement and her service to the community, and also as a fundraiser for her dance company that is a youth dance company, and so that we talked to her first, and it was really wonderful. So you're going to hear her, and I'm going to be telling her thank you so much and all that kind of good stuff. And then Camille and Joyce are going to join us. So here we are.
That is a real pleasure.
Thank you. Same here.
Thank you. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Rose, for joining
us.
And no one called in, but that's okay.
Okay. Just want to say show up tomorrow night.
Totally.
Okay.
Right. Congratulations on your longevity of your career, because I know it wasn't easy.
Oh, dear, but it was a pleasure, all of it.
Right. Great.
Okay.
I'll see you tomorrow night.
Thank you. Look forward to you. Bye, ladies.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Yeah. Well, welcome again. Gosh, it's so wonderful. This is the 29th annual Northern California Book Awards. My goodness, Joyce, you've been doing this for a long time.
That's true. Not from the very beginning, though, I'm happy to say.
Yeah, wow. It's like the event is going to be on Sunday, April 18th, 1 p.m. at the Corrette Auditorium of the San Francisco Main Public Library, 100 Larkin Street. In San Francisco near Groveland is a free event, and you can meet all the wonderful nominees as well as the awardees afterwards in like a reception. And so, Joyce, why don't you tell us about this 29th annual installation of this awards ceremony, and then talk about Camille and Black Nature and about the special recognition award that she is receiving on Sunday.
Okay, I'd be happy to. Just to set the stage for it, we're also giving awards in general nonfiction, creative nonfiction, poetry, children's literature, fiction, translation, and we're giving a Lifetime Achievement Award to Nancy Peters, who's a co-owner and former publisher of City Lights Books in San Francisco. The literary treasure, and worked at the side of Lawrence Ferlinghetti all those years, and has gotten little recognition herself, and it's about time. So
yes,
she will, she will be honored. But Camille Dungy has made this incredible anthology, as you said, Black Nature, Four Centuries of African American Nature Poetry, and as an anthology, of course, it's by multiple authors, so it falls outside of our usual categories, but we simply couldn't let it pass. And we have a special award that is very important to us, that we give to a book, to a literary organization or project that falls outside of our usual categories, that we think is a real stellar addition to Northern California Letters during the last year. So that is why we are honoring this incredible, groundbreaking, pioneering book that has, as Camille will tell you, collects 180 poems from 93 African American poets, and the very concept is groundbreaking. But it's always been, it's of course always been with us, but it's wonderful to recognize it and to have these poems in a book that we can all enjoy and treasure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think it's so wonderful, that the book awards are occurring in the weekend where people are celebrating Earth Day. I mean, people are getting out and cleaning the creeks and sweeping the streets and, just sort of sprucing up the planet and letting the planet
mm-hmm.
know that, we appreciate it, whether we're, close to unpaved, environments or right where we are, in the cities or whatever. And I really like so your references, Camille, when you talk about how, instead of being agrarian, we're now urban, as people of African descent, which is really interesting. Those
so many people are, but which doesn't mean that you can't be in touch
mm-hmm.
with the natural world in all kinds of ways, especially where we live. Come on. In California, you are always surrounded by mountains and creeks and the ocean and these amazing trees and things. But then we also have to attend to the watershed and all these other issues. And one of the concepts that comes across for many of the poems and poets in the anthology is this importance of reclaiming a stake in the world in which we live and on which we depend. And as we move further and further away from that connection, we're robbed of a part of our culture, a part of our heritage, and a part of our future. And so the poets in here are not allowing that absence and that complete disconnection to happen without some sort of conscious attention being paid to it. And so it is really great that this award happens to coincide with Earth Day this year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And funny, Joyce, did you have a favorite mm-hmm. poem that you might want to share from the collection? And I really like the way you you spoke of sort of in your really wonderful introduction, Camille, about, you know, sort of, you know, how, you know, this is going to be like maybe there's going to be another volume because of estates and, you know, different kinds of legal wrangling, you couldn't necessarily, some of the poems that you wanted, you couldn't necessarily get for this particular edition of this tribute to, you know, African-American nature, poetry, and writers. And because I was looking through the table of contents, I'm like, oh, my goodness, she's got so-and-so and so-and-so. It's like, oh, mm-hmm. and I know so-and-so. And
yeah. Right. I mean, there's so many people that I have in here who I'm really excited about who people don't necessarily think of in these terms. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you can never get anybody under one tent, right? And so I really do hope that there can be future volumes and that this just really opens up a field of investigation. Of work that's been hidden in plain sight, that's right there all along.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Hidden in plain sight is exactly the way to look at it. And also, I mean, this is not there are beautiful historical poems in this anthology, but Camille, you've done such a beautiful job of getting the cutting edge in here, getting the sense of contemporary relationship to urban nature and. It's just a spectacular green anthology any way you look at it. It's just wonderful. Camille, I think it's wonderful. I think you should read. You've got such beautiful poems in here that of your own that I think you should read a poem in from it. I think it would be a travesty if I did it.
No, Joyce, you can choose another poem. And Camille, I was actually going to ask you if we could sort of start because I'm so happy that you have June Jordan. Of course you would. Oh. And Lucille Clifton, who I had the honor of being able to meet. And Yusuf Komunyakaa, who I really love. And I forgot that he was the only black man to get the Pulitzer Prize. And I didn't realize it was, like, still the only one, you know.
Isn't that amazing? All these years, the only African-American man.
Yeah.
Yeah,
right. And I remember when he came to town and he was at the International House in Berkeley reading from that collection, and I bought a copy when he, you know, was on the tour after he had gotten the award.
You know, I think I put that reading on.
Oh, okay.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I think I did.
Okay, yeah.
I remember it. Yes, it was wonderful.
Right, yeah, and you know, and Robert Haas and his wife were there, and it was just really, really, really beautiful. And, you know, Joyce, everything you do is always wonderful. You know, I really miss the Cody's readings that you used to host.
But we're still going strong at Moe's Books and at Diesel Books in Oakland.
Okay, I need to get on that list. I think I'm missing those. Because
I
missed all of your readings, Camille. You know, when the book first came out, I was like, oh,
right.
Camille,
I'm on the A-list.
Camille did a beautiful reading in our series from her wonderful new book called Suck on the Marrow. It's really an important book. And you can always find out more about the book awards and those readings that we're talking about from poetryflash.org.
How old is Poetry Flash? That is such a great resource.
It was founded in 72 as a mimeograph sheet with four events on it.
Oh, wow. It's grown considerably. Poetry Flash is the resource for poets from the Bay Area and all over California, really, and poets who come to California know that poetryflash.org is the place to go if they want to figure out who's reading where in the Bay Area in any particular night.
Right, yeah. So, Camille, you're associate professor in creative writing department at San Francisco State and author of What to Eat, What to Drink, and What to Leave with Poison. What a provocative title. And you've also edited two other poetry anthologies. You're really good at this, huh?
And Joyce also mentioned my second collection just came out in January. It's called Suck on the Marrow.
Oh, that okay. And what is that one about?
It is a collection set in mid-19th century America about the experience of slavery from the eyes of free blacks and American whites and enslaved blacks and self-liberated African Americans. And so it's a kind of holistic view from the North and the South of what it means to have had an institution of slavery here in America.
We'll have to have you back on to talk about that.
I would be delighted to do that.
Awesome. So why don't you, I was thinking, I really would love, I mean, you could read other things, but if we could start with language and then do for Alice Walker, A Summertime Tonka, and then Lucille Clifton's Generations.
Oh, wonderful. Those are some of my favorites of the 180. Choosing your favorite would be great. So language is for me a great place to start. It's my own poem from my first collection, What to Eat, What to Drink, What to Leave for Poison, and it sort of helps explain part of why I felt an anthology like this was important, just the deep resonance that I think that the world that is around us has on everything that we do. Language. Silence is one part of speech. The war cry of wind down a mountain pass, another. A stranger's voice echoing through lonely valleys. A lover's voice rising so close, it's your own tongue. These are keys to cipher. The way the high hawk's key unlocks the throat of the sky, and the coyote's yip knocks it shut. The way the aspen's bells conform to the breeze, while the rapid's drum defines resistance. Sage speaks with one voice, pinion with another. Rock, wind her hand, water her brush, spells, and then scatters her demands. Some notes tear and pebble our paths. Some notes gather the bank we map our lives around. And then you wanted Lucille Clifton's Generations. And if the listeners don't know Lucille Clifton, she was one of our great American poets, and she just passed quite recently this year. And so many of us are mourning her loss in person, but she has left a legacy of some amazing, amazing books of poetry. And so we will have those with us forever. Lucille Clifton, Generations. People who are going to be, in a few years, bottoms of trees, bear a responsibility to something besides people. If it was only you and me sharing the consequences, it would be different. It would be just generations of men. But this business of war, these war kinds of things, are erasing those natural, obedient generations who ignored pride, stood on no hind legs, begged no water, stole no bread, did their own things. And the generations of rice, of coal, of grasshoppers, by their invisibility, denounce us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then finally, this is sort of a two-for-one pleasure in this poem. We get two Bay Area African-American women, just fabulous giants, right, of the literary world. It's a poem by June Jordan called For Alice Walker, A Summertime Tonka. Redwood Grove and war, you and me talking Congo, gender, grief, and ash. I say, God, it's all so huge. You say, these sweet trees, this tree.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. Mm. And you also, Camille, talk about a tree and in your introduction, or is that in the first cycle?
It's in the introduction, yeah.
It's in the introduction, right, yeah. And I was wondering if you could talk about sort of that tree and when you were in, I guess, working in
Lynchburg, Virginia.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
I ended up in Lynchburg, Virginia. I'm a California girl. I grew up in Southern California, went to Stanford, and then had an opportunity for a really wonderful graduate education in North Carolina, and then ended up taking a tenure track job in Lynchburg, Virginia, which was a big change for me, though I had a lot of family history there. And I walked a lot because I was a California girl, and I ended up walking around this park all the time that had this tree growing in a swimming pool. And it was growing out of the mechanism, the tank pump mechanism of the swimming pool. The swimming pool had been filled in haphazardly, so the dirt kind of sloped down inside it. There was moss around the outside. You could still really tell that this had been a swimming pool. I found it eerie and strange and began to investigate and discovered that I can't directly recall the years, but someplace between 68 and 72, so late in the civil rights movement, a group of African-American children and adults staged a swim-in in this pool. And rather than desegregating the city pool, the city filled all the city pools with dirt and wouldn't let anybody, black or white kids, swim in the city pool rather than integrating the pool. Eventually, the pools were reopened because too many children were drowning in the rivers and creeks in the area. And so just for public safety reasons, they finally did reopen the pools because you had to be very wealthy and white and go to the country club if you're going to have the safety of a pool. But that tree, to me, was so galling and also beautiful. Itself was this beautiful tree. You could never clear the dirt out of that pool and start over again. It had sort of taken over the mechanism, the very mechanism that would have let children recreate in this space. And it just seemed to me such a statement about the ways in which racial hatred and segregation and violence all tangle up in the roots of our natural world. And so I start the anthology telling the story and telling how by paying attention to that tree, I started learning about the history of the place where I had landed and asking questions and then paying attention to the creeks and seeing how it was that in these creeks kids were dying, because I could see how I walked one day and it was fine and the next day there was an eddy and a whirlpool someplace. And so that attention to the history made me attend to the natural landscape, and that with a lot of African-American poetry that uses language about the natural world, we're also talking about politics, we're talking about culture, we're talking about history, we're talking about segregation and brutality. And so frequently the nature part of the poem gets forgotten. But for me, it's a huge, important aspect of it. It's what got me there to begin with. And so that is part of what I'm really trying to bring forward in this anthology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Joyce, have you found your poem yet?
Oh, I really, honestly, that just would be silly. I mean, Camille we have...
Is there one you'd like me to read, Joyce?
We have the maestro here, so why? That's ridiculous. But not that. I mean, you're completely wonderful, Wanda. I just meant that it's just that I honestly just love this anthology as a whole. The way the threads come in and out of it, and probably the poems I love best are. Longer poems that would be less good to read on the air, but there are just so many. I just love it. Comes at it from so many different directions, like Wanda Coleman.
Yeah.
You know, it's edgy and fresh and C.S. Giscombe, who's now teaching at UC Berkeley, and Harriet Mullen, and just from, and mixed up with Langston Hughes, who of course you expect to see, but to see those, that to see them juxtaposed against the old standards, if you will, but yet standards that we perhaps have never looked at from this perspective, and it's just beautiful.
So I really liked I was really sort of like highlighting the poems of all of the Lucille Clifton. I have all those marked.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, okay, yeah, because even your inscription is Lucille Clifton.
And even like Patricia Smith, the great poetry slam poet, read so many times at the Bowery Poetry Club in New York, and all mixed up with Youssef Komunyakaa, as we said, Audre Lorde. I mean, what's not to love? It's just,
yeah.
It really is. I'm not kidding. It's a very impressive, very moving selection of poems. So this is not easy to make. It's easy to sit down and just make an anthology of poetry. People do it all the time. But to make an anthology that means something, that people can pick up, and almost any poem you go to will is moving and actually builds in a beautiful way on the poems that surround it, and makes this new perspective, which is an old perspective, but unearths this perspective for all of us. It's really an achievement, and I have to hand it to you, Camille. It's not only the epiphany that you had that, sparked the anthology, but the job of scholarship and love of word that is so clear in the crafting of this anthology.
Thanks, Joyce. I think that my first two books are books that read from front to back, that read particularly Seca de Mero as a novel in verse. And so I had, with my own work, taken the time to construct collections that could engross somebody from the beginning and keep them turning one page and then the next and then the next. And that so frequently with anthologies, and I am a teacher of poetry, I've been at San Francisco State now for 4 years, but I've been teaching at the university level since 1997. And so I read a lot of anthologies, and they're alphabetized frequently or chronologically organized. My last name ends with D, and I unfortunately frequently stop at the D's when I read those alphabetical anthologies. And so I wanted to make sure that people would read all the way through. And so I organized this in 10 cycles that move through different senses of perception of the natural world. It starts with a section called Just Looking, in which people really, without many external fetters, are just looking and appreciating the landscape. And then it moves into more complicated poems that talk about alienation and disenfranchisement and urban or northern migrations and slavery and history, and talk about, there's a section there in the middle called Forsaken of the Earth, which talks about the many, many, many floods we've had on the Mississippi River Delta that inordinately affect Black people, right? And then we move again back into another kind of connection and reconnection, and the final section is called Come Always Spring, where there's a regeneration and a kind of promise of a future in which we can really have a stake in and care about and be rewarded by that caring and responsibility for the natural world. And so you move through this cycle as you carry through the book. There's also, I should say, prose sections, because I know a lot of people feel intimidated by poetry and they don't know quite how to approach it. And so each section is introduced by a small essay written often by poets. Alice Walker writes one that I just find stunning. Richard Wright has one that is incredible also, and then some other contemporary poets I commissioned. And that these sort of help you understand what it is that you're going to get in that next section and help people who might feel a little bit less confident around poetry get their bearings before they jump right into the poems. And so I was really consciously trying to build a collection that could be readable from start to finish and accessible for people who are less comfortable for poetry and yet also critically rigorous for people who make their livelihoods studying poetry.
I really like the Ann Spencer Earth, I Thank You. Earth, I thank you for the pleasure of your language. You've had a hard time bringing it to me from the ground to grunt through the noun to all the way feeling, seeing, smelling, touching, awareness. I am here. That's really lovely. Mm-hmm. I really also appreciate your having poetry by Phyllis Wheatley and Horton. You know, some of the first people to be published, you know, of African descent in this country. You know, they're like the foundation of the genre. And I remember hearing about Moses Horton through Maya Angelou. Mm-hmm. That's how I knew about his work, because everyone knows Phyllis Wheatley. And the piece that you have of hers that I really love is that one called Imagination?
On Imagination.
Yeah, yeah. That's
and what she talks about and the lines that I'm really keying in on, she has several lines that are important to me, but the lines that I really key in on are, these northern climes forbid me to aspire. She's talking about Boston. She's this girl who's been stolen from the west coast of Africa and is brought to Boston, right? It's freezing cold. And so she's talking literally about the weather that forbids her aspiration, but also, of course, of the climate, the cultural climate, the historical climate, the slavery that she comes into. And so, entanglement about talking about the natural world and the landscape, but that can't be separated from the facts of her life. And the Ann Spencer is a poet writing during the Harlem Renaissance era, who was living in Virginia. She didn't live in Harlem. And her work was often afterwards dismissed because she supposedly wasn't writing in the political way that you ought to have been writing, because she was often writing about her garden. If you look at the poems, she's got this poem in this collection called White Things, which she wrote in direct response to the lynching of the pregnant woman, when the pregnant woman is hung from a bridge, and she just was so horrified by that particular act of brutality, and she wrote this stunning, stunning poem in this collection that then gets read as just, you know, not a political poem, because she's talking about the natural world in it, and it's a really, really searing portrait of brutality and dismissal, as she's also talking about poppies and fields and things. It's an incredible mind. So I was happy to be able to highlight some of these poetic minds that get erased or forgotten or marginalized because they're not speaking in the way we expect people to speak.
Yeah, and as you speak about these various writers, you know, those that are with us, you know, presently, or those that have made their transition, you know, I can hear your passion and you know, they're like friends, you know, you really know them.
Yeah.
Which I think is really like, doesn't it sound just like, you know, hey, they come over for tea and, you know, hang out with Camille. It's like, nice.
Well, you know, I did work a long time. I mean, 3 years, probably 20 to 30 hours a week on this collection. So I did really come to know these writers. And a lot of them I've been collecting and thinking about in these terms well before the opportunity to publish with the University of Georgia Press. Thankfully came along, and so it was a welcome opportunity to debut my friends, as it were. But I absolutely think, you know, I'm a poet, and we build our communities, and we do not just build our communities from our living peers, but from people who have been writing across the ages. That's who I admire, that's who I learn from, and so it's an opportunity to give back in that way.
Well, I want to let our audience know we're speaking to Camille T. Dungy, whose book, Black Nature, Four Centuries of African-American Nature Poetry, that she edited, is receiving the Special Recognition Award this weekend at the 29th Annual Northern California Book Awards, Sunday, April 18th, 1 p.m. at the Corette Auditorium, San Francisco, Maine, Public Library, 100 Larkin Street, and it's a free event. And so you come on out and you meet all these wonderful writers, and then afterwards you get, you know, get some little things to eat, and you can buy the books, and you can just mingle and meet all these great thinkers. And we're also joined by Joyce Jenkins, a wonderful treasure here in the San Francisco Bay Area that's been keeping poetry, you know, really in the forefront with reading series, as well as her work with the Northern California Book Awards. I'm not going back 29 years, but going back pretty far. And we have our next guest is in the studio, so I've got like some poems that I really like, but since I can't have you read them all, Camille, I'll just tell you which ones I really like, and you could surprise me.
Okay.
I like the Nikki Giovanni for Sandra. I like the Gwendolyn Brooks and Arna Bontemps, Sick Man Looks at Flowers and Prodigal. I think I can get two for one there. I like, again, Lucille Clifton, Mulberry Fields, and E. Ethelbert Miller's I'm Black and the Trees Are Green. I think I can get two for one there.
Mm.
And I love Margaret Walker's Southern Song. And there's one more, Indigo Moore's Taproot. I just think that's just really stunning about the Mississippi River. So
Muddy Waters, the blues musician Muddy Waters came from this area of the Mississippi that then was the river was diverted, you know, and so interesting how so much of our cultural history is really tied up in the ground, and we oughtn't forget it. I'm going to read Prodigal just because we are a California show, and one thing that I'm quite proud of about this anthology is that so much of publishing can't so much to the east of the Mississippi. And because I am a California girl, I saw a lot of writing coming out of the American West that doesn't necessarily get highlighted as much. And so this book actually has 25% of the poems are somehow connected to the American West, and I'm pretty proud of the fact that this national anthology has this kind of scope. So I'm going to read the Arna Bontemps poem because he was really a California writer.
And also you need to, we can do two for one there because you can also do Gwendolyn Brooks.
The Gwendolyn Brooks. Okay, we're on the same page. Okay.
and she's a Gemini, and so am I.
Okay, and she's so marvelous. And that, too, it's an urban poem, which I find so marvelous about it. Okay, so this is the Arna Bontemps poem.
Okay.
Prodigal. I shall come back when dogwood flowers are going and passing drakes are honking toward the south with eager necks. I shall come back knowing the old unanswered question on your mouth. When frost is on the manzanita shoots and dogwoods at the spring are turning brown, there, between the interlacing roots, with folding arms, I shall at last go down. And then Gwendolyn Brooks, writing out of Chicago, right? So we often think, oh, if you're a nature poet, you have to be out in the woods somewhere in the wilderness. She was writing right there in Bronzeville. Sick man looks at flowers. You are sick and old, and there is a closing in. The eyes gone dead to all that could entice. Echoes are dull, and the body accepts no touch except its pain. Mind is a little isle. But now invades this audacity of red, this ripe rebuke, this burgeoning affluence mocks me and mocks the desert of my bed.
Yeah, cool. Well, thank you both so much. Thank you, Camille, and congratulations. Will you be back in town? Because I know you're traveling presently.
I know. I'm trying to wrangle with the airlines to get back in town, but if not, my fabulous chief of staff, my wonderful husband, Ray Black, will accept the award for me if I am not able to be there, and he'll read some poems and talk about the poems and deliver a talk for me if I can't get United to bring me home on time.
And the anthology will be completely celebrated no matter what, and we'll have it available for purchase there, and we'll all be there cheering it on.
And again, Camille is being honored. However, there are going to be a whole lot of other, you know, great writers, you know, the translation, fiction, poetry, creative nonfiction, general nonfiction, fiction, the Fred Cody Award for Lifetime Achievement going to co-owner and former publisher of City Lights Books, Nancy J. Peters. So it's going to be, it's just a really wonderful celebration of literary arts. Right. And again, this year, the Northern California Book Awards is going to be the 32nd annual now. It's going to be in the same place, the San Francisco Main Library and the Corette Auditorium, and it's going to be happening on Sunday, May 19th, and that's Malcolm X's birthday. And this month is National Poetry Month, so there are poetry readings happening all over the place, and I think during this month there is the National Dance Week, so there's going to be dancing happening all over the place too. And then there's the National Library Week that's also part of this month. So there's a whole lot of great things to think about when we celebrate April. And so anyway, I'm going to read the poem by Indigo Moore, Taproot, from Black Nature, Four Centuries of African-American Nature Poetry, edited by Camille T. Dungy. One. Concrete and steel drew the Mississippi back like a fist. Scythe blade swung through dry harvests. Plows turned soil hard enough to raise the blues. Muddy water sprang whole, dry heaved from the knotted center of a plank wood shack. Shook himself loose of blood, dirt, moonshine, and the a dark end of a mule and was gone. Two. Since twisters have spun the shack round, bent its insides out till it vomited its secrets on boot dust roads. Now tourists use splintered slivers of history as toothpicks. A little ways down the road, you can squander a week's pay, sleep in an old slave shack, spend a day picking cotton, smile for pictures. Three. The Mississippi used to cover these parts till they dammed it up, held its tongue like words you choked back in church to keep your insides from escaping. Staring across dusty fields, you can ache the need for river, almost drown in longing for waters that won't come here no more. And that's Indigo Moore's Taproot. Stephanie Pewitt, Mississippi Gardens. Slaves, she answered as I sink my fingers beneath the roots. The knees of that blue house dress are threadbare. She wears it on Tuesdays and Fridays when we tend the flowers. Pulling weeds ain't a time for talk, she chides. I watch her uproot the creeping Charlie. The fragrant blossoms we protect hug our whole house. Sweet peas were my choice. We rarely buy those things for sale in the gardening aisle. Don't make sense to work the earth and not feel it. I wanted those thick cotton gloves, but they stayed on the shelf. You got to learn the difference between dirt and soil. Sometimes I notice how the ground changes, denser, darker, moister, a little more red in some places. In social studies class, I learned about crop rotation and how it keeps the land fertile. Mama, what did they used to grow here? And that's Stephanie Pruitt. And the last one I'm going to read from the collection is Gerald Barrick Senior. I call them trees. The last time I went to the library, I looked at the flowers surrounding the statue of Stephen Collins Foster and the old darkie ringing the banjo at his feet. Flowers planted in four triangular beds alternating red and white. I saw they were all the same kind. There were others in front of the building in long, wide, rectangular rows bordered by round clusters of pastel green and white that were too deep, too dark, red, maroon for easy images. I called them all flowers. And the stunted trees I wished I had known bending over the green terrace above the flowers like women whose faces I couldn't see washing their hair in deep green pools, I called trees. If I had told you, would you have known them? Flowers. There were flowers for me. There were trees. There were kinds of birds and something blue that crouched in the green day waiting for evening. If I had told you, would you have known? I sat on a beach among flowers and trees facing the traffic, surveying all I knew of impalas, cougars, falcons, barracudas, mustangs, wildcats, marlins, watching cars go by. I named them all. that's so beautiful. And again, that's from Camille's collection, Black Nature, Four Centuries of African American Nature Poetry. And I forgot to mention that in the city of Alameda, they're also going to be having an Earth Day celebration tomorrow, the 20th. And tonight at the Oakland Museum, they're having their evening hours. They're going to be having a celebration. And that starts at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And we're going to close our show with the interview with Judy Juanita. We're not going to get to the interview with Miss Rosin, Rachel Rosin, because it's too long. So tune in on Wednesday, and we'll play that wonderful interview where she talks about San Francisco International Film Festival and what's in store for us on its 56th anniversary, which opens again April 25th and continues through May 9th. So that's going to be a conversation and a show you don't want to miss. So we're going to play this interview with Judy Juanita. You can catch Judy Juanita tonight at 7 o'clock at Books, Inc. in Alameda as well. So Alameda is going to be happening because it's the first interview for Judy Juanita on her book tour, celebrating the new release of her first novel. She's a veteran writer, but this is her first novel. And we had a wonderful conversation yesterday. So enjoy. So, Miss Judy Juanita, congratulations on your first novel, Virgin Soul.
Thank you so much.
I don't know how you do it all. I mean, you write plays, and they've been produced here in the Bay Area as well as in New York City, and you write poetry, and you had short fiction, but this is your first novel.
Yes, yes, but everything one at a time.
Right. And then you're a teacher. Oh, my goodness. How do you do that? You've been teaching at Laney College, those lucky students.
Yes, 20 years.
Yeah, you keep your day, you keep that gig going, I think because you probably love passing it on, huh?
Yes. And also I love eating.
Oh, come on now. With all the publishing that you've done, you know, novels, plays, et cetera.
Very little money coming in up until the advance for the novel.
Okay.
Yeah, no. It was not a money arrangement at all. All the plays. Playwriting definitely takes a lot of, really a lot of money to put a play up.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very difficult. And poetry is free, as any poet knows.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah.
But then the novelist, oh my goodness. So you're going to be being nominated, I'm sure, for the Bay Area Literary Awards that happens in April by the Book Reviewers Association.
Well, that would be for last year's books, so maybe it would happen.
No, I meant for this coming year, the 2014. That's what I'm talking
right about.
Yeah, because your book is hitting the streets when? Next week?
Today.
Oh, today. Ah, yes, that's right.
That's right,
yeah. April 18th.
Available in bookstores everywhere.
Yeah, and folks are going to be able to hear you read from your book and talk about it at Books, Inc. tomorrow evening in Alameda at 7 o'clock,
yes.
Friday, April 19th.
Yes.
Yeah, and then you'll be in you know, Earth Day, the 20th, you'll be in Los Angeles at the Festival of Books. That sounds fun.
Right.
20th and the 21st.
Festival.
Yeah, and you'll be back up here in Berkeley and San Francisco and Oakland, a couple of places.
A big book signing on May 4th at 2 p.m. That's Saturday, May 4th at the 57th
Street
Gallery.
Yeah. So are you going to have some music, too?
Not really. There may be someone playing a little bit, but we're going to have a panel discussion with some friends of mine who were Panthers, and we were Panthers together.
Okay. Oh, who's going to be on the panel with you?
The real Clarence Thomas. Do you know? Do you know the real Clarence Thomas?
Yeah, Clarence Thomas. Yeah, he's a union organizer. Mm-hmm.
Yes, Clarence Thomas and I were husband and wife for many years.
Oh.
Yeah, and we have a beautiful son together, so he's going to be there.
Okay.
And Benny Stewart, who was one of the co-founders and presidents of the Black Student Union, and he's also a community organizer.
Mm-hmm.
And Janice Garrett Forte, who was my roommate and is still my very good friend, and she was Bobby Seale's original assistant and scheduler.
Wow.
Yes. And some others said they would be there. So
this
ought to be very interesting, very lively.
Oh, certainly. So that's 2 o'clock on Saturday, May 4th.
Yes.
At the 57th Street Gallery, which is on 57th and Telegraph in Oakland.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're going to be, in June, you're going to be at the Peralta Hacienda Historical Park. That's
yes.
at 2 o'clock as well, Saturday, June 2nd. And my daughter and I are part of the current exhibit there, Oakland Telling
Their
Stories.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, interesting. That should be nice. That's a wonderful, wonderful space that Holly Alonso and her folks have kept going in these slim economic times for arts organizations.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So you answered a couple of my questions, and you're telling me about the big panel, because I was wondering, how do you know all these things? How does your character, you know, you're a Janice girl, how does she know all this? And I'm like, I mean, there are places your imagination can go, and there's a whole lot of research you can do, but Janice is certainly an insider.
Yes, I read a review, a blog review, which was very wonderful, and then he said, the only thing is the author inserts herself in these scenes with Eldridge Cleaver and Huey Newton, and that's a weakness of the story. And otherwise, it was really glowing, and I just laughed to myself, you know, because I wanted to say, dude, I was there.
Mm-hmm.
I was editor-in-chief of the party newspaper for a time. I was appointed by Huey Newton. I did know Huey Newton at Oakland City College, you know, but this is a time to make that clear then.
Wow. Go ahead. Keep on going.
And I did meet, I did meet Huey and Bobby at Oakland City College, which was its name before it was Merritt College and before it was the Grove Street campus. And I entered college at 16, which, you know, as a teacher at Laney, I mean, at College of Alameda, we have many students who come at a very early age. Either they're coming through advanced placement or the schools are just sending them there. But I graduated from high school at 16 and enrolled at Oakland City right away. Met Huey there. I was not a radical during my first 2 years there. I was strictly concentrating on getting out. But I loved watching and listening to the radicals. It was purely entertainment. We left class. We went to class. After class, we went back out on the front lawn on what was then Grove Street, listened to all of the soapbox orators go on and on and on, and it was really just laughs for us at that time. I didn't know I was imbibing radicalism. We were just fascinated. They were smart. They could talk a mile a minute. They were older. We respected them. They were geniuses. Mm-hmm. One of them is named Ernest Allen. We called him Ernie Allen, and he's a professor at UMass, and his younger brother, Doug Allen, wrote Sugary Rising, the novel.
Jesse.
Yeah, and I knew him as Doug. I grew up with them in East Oakland.
Wow, yeah, I just had Jesse on my show. I had to have him on twice. I might have him on for a third time to talk about Sugary. Yeah, we talked about the female characters the last time we spoke, which was earlier this month, although this month is still early. It's like the middle of it. Wow.
So this was a scene, and we just loved watching it, along with all of the other things that we did at Oakland City College. It was the place to be. It was very hip. It was very, it was a party scene, always, continuously. And to be 16 when I started was quite an energizing moment in my life. So I was paying attention to everything, and I was writing on the school paper. As usual, I always wrote on school papers from junior high school on.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a chance then to convince my editor, as the Janice does in the book, that to let me write about these student radicals.
Yeah.
And that's when I went and to interview them and found out that most of them weren't students there. They were just militants, and they were activists. But I found out that they were geniuses, and they had degrees, and you know, many of them went on to get further degrees. But it was just an interesting moment in time. However, I didn't know that I was being, in a sense, watched or tracked.
Mm-hmm.
But some years later, when I was active in the Panther Party and there was this shootout in West Oakland, I had been helping Eldridge Cleaver with the newspaper. And after the shootout, when Eldridge was jailed and little Bobby was killed, then Huey appointed me editor-in-chief of the paper in Eldridge's absence.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a total surprise.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty much at that moment, just like in the book, everything really changed, you know.
Mm-hmm.
My life just took a 180-degree change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what about some of the famous people that you have your character, Geneva Anise Hightower, hanging with Mary Baraka and his wife, whom we know now as Amina, right?
Yes.
And
we're right there. We met them at the Black House.
Oh, okay.
That was he was an adjunct faculty member.
Mm-hmm.
We brought him on campus, and he helped us get a Black Arts troupe started.
Hmm.
And I was a part of that. I was pretty much the opener all the time,
mm-hmm.
reading poetry.
Mm-hmm.
So we traveled up and down the peninsula, in and around most of the larger cities with Black populations in the Bay Area.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and then what about the San Francisco State part? Where did you work at San Francisco State in the admissions?
Yes, I did.
and so like your character is responsible for getting making the recommendation and that more African American students be admitted.
Did that happen
for real?
Yes. Yes.
They were
going to say, let's try for 40 students.
Mm-hmm.
And I explained the 2% rule, and I said, why don't we do 400?
Wow. So how do you remember all this? Were you keeping a journal or something?
Yes, I did.
Oh, okay.
The time, but about 2 years after I had graduated from San Francisco State, I, by then, had been married to Clarence Thomas, whom we called Buzz at the time. So Buzz and I were married. We have this beautiful little son named Juno. And so I was home for a bit.
Mm-hmm.
I started writing down all these recollections. I realized how important the era was.
Mm-hmm.
And basically in a notebook, I just wrote down every single name, every single nickname, the ways that people greeted each other, which were totally unique. That's what I was doing. I was just kind of remembering. I was just notating everything that I remembered. And then right after that, I began writing stories. And I did have a grandiose idea about a novel at that time, but I really didn't have the craft to write a novel at that point.
Mm-hmm.
But I just shelved it, and I kept returning to it about every decade because I'd get more skills, more writing skills. But it just didn't gel for a long time, and I was content because I'm a reader, and I was reading novels, and I was reading poetry, and I just knew that I had to develop myself.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So your characters, juggling her academic with her activism, that's something that you experienced yourself?
In the last, in the junior and senior year.
Yeah, uh-huh, right,
yes.
Exactly. Wow, that's amazing. And, I don't want to give away the book, so I won't ask you that.
Okay.
Wow, this is, I never thought you were in the book. I just assumed that you were just,
good.
I just assumed that you're just a fabulous writer, which you are. So I'm like, but I knew you had to do a lot of research to be able to make a Janice. I mean, this Janice is so involved in the inner workings of the Black Panther Party that, you had to do a whole lot of digging and research and have a whole, and I thought she was a prototype, actually. I was going to ask you, is she a prototype?
She is. She's not Judy.
Yeah.
We're very different. And one of the things that I purposely did in making her different was to make her dark-skinned.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to address the issues of colorism and skin prejudice mm-hmm. in our mm-hmm. community.
Right, and hair.
Yes, and hair. Mm-hmm.
Wow. This is just wonderful. So, interesting. So tell us about Janice's family. I don't know if that also reflects your family, because she is raised by an extended family. She's not raised by her mother and father. She's raised by relatives within the family. And I was wondering about your decision to make her an orphan, but not, be raised by non-relatives.
Right, that was very different from my own background. I was always very close to my own mother and father,
mm-hmm.
and came from a two-parent family. But I needed to have her be independent and have her be questioning people around her and questioning her own identity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and she does that throughout the book. It's just really wonderful. I sort of savored it. It's really funny that that you're friends with Jesse from way back, because I felt the same way with his book. Just wanted to savor the journey, and so I would just read a little bit, sort of like dessert.
Yes.
So I've been stretching this book out for a long time, because like, and then I got to it and I was like, oh, I'm done. I need to read it again now.
Yes. Doug's sister and I were very good friends.
Mm-hmm.
Doug's a lot younger than I am, a little younger. But his sister Bonnie and I mm-hmm. were in the same grade, and we were in the Girl Scout and the Brownie troops
mm-hmm.
together.
Mm-hmm.
And so I knew her very, very well. I didn't know Doug that well,
mm-hmm.
but Bonnie and I were very good friends.
Yeah, yeah, neat. So as you know, this is your first novel. Why don't you talk about, you know, some of the delightful aspects that you know, as a writer, you know, happened for you. Maybe you didn't know because it's your first novel, but just sort of as you were writing it, or now that it's done, just sort of maybe talk about that journey and how it differs from writing poetry and writing plays. I mean, there are characters in both, but one thing about the novel is it's a bigger terrain. So why don't you talk about just sort of some of the things you discovered about this particular kind of process of writing and some of the things you really enjoyed.
Well, one of the things is I like the idea of this vast terrain,
mm-hmm.
and it's but it's also something that I can get lost in.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to cut many, many pages from this in order to satisfy the commercial demand, so to speak. But I liked being able to extend my vision. I like being able to write in response to a lot of ideas and people. And perhaps it's too much, but I liked doing that. And I felt very comfortable whenever I opened up, I noticed, whenever I opened up my computer and got into this world, the world of the book, mm-hmm. I was very comfortable. I could hear the dialogue. I was there. It wasn't at all foreign to me. It was comfortable. It was comfortable. And I was really comfortable doing it for a long time. I went to a party and one of my friends said, I said, oh, I just finished this, you know, umpteenth revision. And he said, oh, Judy, is this going to be a yearly project with you? And I realized, okay, it's time to let it go. Even my really close friends are beginning to see it's kind of obsessive and compulsive with me, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I like that that aspect of it. It's really like a garden. It's you're watching something grow, and you go to it, and you count the pages, and you look at how this character changed over time. It's a revelation. Keeps revealing depth to you as you go on. So I found it very interesting process.
I like that gardening metaphor. Wow, yeah, that's very nice. Yeah. Would you like to share something from the book?
Sure.
Okay.
Let's see. Okay.
Maybe something earlier and then something later.
Okay. This is a part on chapter 6,
mm-hmm.
and she's become close with Allwood.
Oh, yeah, like him. He was a really different kind of intellectual, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah, like when he took her books. Are you going to share that part? What he did to her.
Actually, that is, yes. It's called, I call it the 10 books chapter. I had them named.
The 10 books chapter. I like that. You didn't name them in our books, but that's
no, I, they didn't want the names. They just wanted numbers.
Oh.
Anyway, but I call it the 10 books chapter. So
okay.
Here it is. So it goes on, let's see. It goes on for about, yeah, it's just about 5 pages.
Mm-hmm, sure.
Yeah, do you have time for that? Or?
Yeah, no problem.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
Allwood and I went out for hamburgers and movies at the Fox Oakland. We walked down Telegraph Avenue in Berkeley, checking out the free speech orators, soapbox evangelists, and secondhand bookstores. Then we'd go back to city, to the street orators rapping rapid fire about Cuba, Black history, the man. The Harvard guy loved to rant on LBJ's participation in the Kennedy assassination. The man is out to get you. The man is out to get you, brothers and sisters. Wake up. The man is out to get you. With utmost authority, he talked about Johnson being in on the assassination and jacking off in Kennedy's neck wound on Air Force One. It was hard for me to picture that with Mrs. Kennedy in the bloodstained pink Chanel in the front of the plane. But I had a boyfriend, and he was cute. I thought we would have our first fight over sex. not the intellect. It didn't matter to me. We went for pizza and bowling, for spaghetti and peewee golf, but all that wasn't enough for Allwood, not nearly enough. This one Friday night, when I had made him drag us to the miniature golf range in San Leandro, right as we were about to begin the second of 9 holes, he gave me a list, a reading list. What is this for? This is your real education. Read these 10 books. The revolution starts in your mind. I didn't know revolution from Adam, but I knew that F. Scott Fitzgerald had given Sheila Graham a reading list of the classics. My Western Civ instructor had talked about it with a big smirk. If Allwood wanted to play it that way, I was not game, but I listened to the list out of curiosity. Muntu by Jan Hynes Jan, David Walker's Appeal, never heard of them. Black Boy by Richard Wright, I read that in high school, brother man, I said, driving the ball to the green. You need to read it again, Allwood said. You have a different head now. He read on, trailing behind me, my caddy with his list. The Rebirth of African Civilization by Chancellor Williams, Illusion and Reality by Caldwell, never heard of them, couldn't even front it off. But I wanted to have read them. I wanted to know everything that Allwood and the Harvard Soapbox Orator and all the rest knew. If it was all info in a book, why couldn't I know it? I was a reader. I was a student. I wanted to be smart. Not the smart of the white kids transferring to Berkeley, not the pseudo-smart of the black bougies coasting on their skin color, but the smart of the radicals who I respected because they weren't cowed by anybody, least of all the passers-by on Grove Street throwing insults and soda cans at them. Allwood's list was unrelenting. The Wretched of the Earth by F. Fanon. Allwood, that's only the Bible. How many midday rallies have I watched? I have eyes. I handed him the club so I could see the list for myself. I hadn't heard of the next two, Black Nationalism, A Search for an Identity in America by E.U. Essien Udom, and Return to My Native Land by Aimé Césaire. But the ninth one on the list, The Souls of Black Folk by W.E.B. Du Bois, was very familiar. There's a copy of this in Uncle Boy Boy and Aunt Ola Ray's library, for heaven's sakes. Well, I know you know the last one on the list, Allwood said, lining up the clubhead with the ball as if he was Jack Nicklaus. But I put it there so you could reread it after you've tackled the rest. It was The Fire Next Time by James Baldwin. Well, thanks for some credit, I said. I didn't know how Sheila had felt with F. Scott, but I was too through. Do you think you're dealing with an illiterate? I know some things. Okay, maybe I don't read as much as you. Maybe not even a tenth, but I'm in... I sputtered. I wanted to say intelligent, but Allwood was an intellectual. I was neither. We went up to my room at the Y. We could have day guests. Allwood walked over to my bookcase and pointed at the middle shelf, the eye level shelf, my spot. I could go there blindfolded and pick up my favorites. He sneered as he began yanking titles off the shelf. Yes, Mr. Intellect, I love Taylor Caldwell and William Goldman. Calm down, I had to tell myself, as I began thinking about plowing through the books I hadn't read. He took all Cal transfer courses, could speed read 9 or 10 books a week, went through the Crown, the Trib, the Wall Street Journal, and then some. I respected his intelligence. Allwood said, paperback books have given the petty bourgeoisie an inflated ego problem. I read, therefore I am. He pulled out my copy of Philip Roth's Letting Go, my all-time favorite. Allwood snatched out a couple of pages at random. I didn't believe I was seeing him do that, or that I was sitting there waiting to see how much more he would do. I sat there, half shell-shocked, half alert. What was this Negro going to do with my motley paper crew? He continued tearing out pages at random. Ugh. A hard head makes a sore back. I heard Grandma Goosey's scratchy voice from somewhere, but his back looked perfectly straight. Maybe I was the one sitting there like I had lockjaw. I managed to tear my lockjaws open. What are you doing, you crazy-ass MF? Those are mine. Did I tell you to even touch them, fool? Allwood continued, going from Roth to Bello to Mailer to Malamud to Moravia. He threw all the pages he had torn out into the wastebasket, and then he struck a match. "Oh, no, are you absolutely and totally gone?" I leaped up. He set the fire with one movement of his hand. "What did you call me?" he said, looking devilish, enjoying himself while I beat out flames and rushed to open a window. "Now, go back and read those books and see if you missed anything. See if you missed a beat," he said. "They ain't got to write tight. Uncle Sam said, 'Jew boy, you can write all night as long as that's all you do. Write till you ain't got words left to write with. That's how I want to keep you occupied. And you think the Jew boy's Bibles are sacred.'" "Moravia is Italian," I said, peering from the smoke, my own uncertain outrage and the sight of my paperback books burning. "The Jew boys are a bunch of crybabies and jerk-offs," he said. "Don't cry for them. Do you think they bother to cry when we go down in flames?" Allwood stood next to me as particles of soot drifted out the window. "Do you honestly think they cried at their desks when Watts went down?" I didn't care what they did at their desk. All I wanted was to read what was left of my books to see if Allwood was right. Would I miss anything? Was letting go overwritten? I grabbed it and pages fell from my fingers, smudging them. A part that had been torn out but not burned was about E.E. Cummings, or E.E. Cunningham, as the Gruber character called him. I remember Gruber saying, "What is that stuff supposed to be anyway, a poem?" I remembered the phrase, "Culture is everywhere," on one page, and Sarah Vaughan singing on the next page, which was now dust to dust. The smoke that twisted into my nostrils had a scent not unlike a row of hot combs. My tears fell on my torn-up paperbacks, a muddle of print and soot, and I pictured Philip Roth standing side by side with Erlitha, Aunt Ola Ray's beautician. Erlitha had hot-combed my hair every 2 weeks from the time I was 11 until I left home. I could see Philip Roth standing in sweaty, hot Our Beauty Shop on 85th Avenue and East 14th Street, Erlitha telling him in her impatient, fast-talking way, "Oh, no, we don't need any of that in here. Maybe you want to go up on Bancroft or MacArthur, where white folks do hair." Telling him that as she directed traffic, the back and forth between her beauticians, clientele, all in various stages of unpressed and undressed hair, the slick Ricks bringing in hot clothes and hot watches, the churchy women scurrying in with the brown paper bags from Safeway with the oil and steam stains coming from the fried chicken dinners inside them. "But you don't understand," Roth would say, holding my restored, intact copy of Letting Go in hand. "Jews are not white." "Well, what color are they?" Erlitha would ask, resting the straightening iron on the burner, her hand on her hip. "You look white to me." "Everybody makes that mistake. I'm telling you, everybody," Roth would reply. "White is as white does," Erlitha would tell him, looking at his book with disdain. "The only way you can prove it is for you to tell me something that ain't white people. Can you write about colored people?" "We call them Schwartzes. No. Can you write people like this?" Erlitha would have gestured to the people in the shop, the people orbiting around her as if having hair like white folks, which they neither wake up with nor come out of the shower with, is the sole objective of colored existence. That world I grew up in was just like the one phrase I remembered perfectly from the novel, a world full of people pushing and pulling at each other with absolutely clear conscience. So, leave it at that.
Yes, that is so memorable. Yeah, I like Allwood. I like your character. Yeah, he's a great first boyfriend.
Yes, I was sorry to see him go when he had to leave the novel.
Yeah, well, he had a good reason to leave. But it's really interesting how he gives Janice a standard to measure her other beaux by.
Yes.
And so that's really good that you gave her a good standard, because she meets some other guys. Do not, they have their moments of brilliance, but they don't hold up in the long term.
Right.
Yeah. And as you know, Janice is a really wonderful, I guess, example of the type of people that make, you know, our organizations run. You know, we think about movements, but who are the people that are the movement, right? And Janice is one of those people because I know she says to herself often that, you know, she's behind the scenes. You know, she's the one that's laying out the paper.
Absolutely.
late at night.
The little people.
You know, Billy X calls them the foot soldiers.
Foot soldiers. She's a foot.
Yeah, she definitely is, and she realizes that. However, she doesn't undermine her own importance, because if it wasn't for her, you know, the paper wouldn't get out. And I like her interaction. You have her interacting with Kathleen Cleaver and, you know, sort of hanging with, you know, the higher echelon, but standing her ground and knowing her importance and not being bullied.
Yes.
Which is really, really
that
cool.
Actually did happen. Yes.
Oh, seriously, it did, huh?
Yes.
And, well, San Francisco State seems like a continuation of the spokespeople out, you know, at Oakland City College, only it's just a bigger platform, a bigger arena to have these kind of conversations and talks and poetry events, you know, so it seems like a larger forum.
Yes.
Did you go to San Francisco State?
Yes.
Oh, so you did say you did that. And did you get your MFA there, or did you transfer?
I got both the BA way back in the day, and then I got the MFA much later.
Okay. Yeah. Wow.
That's great.
Mm-hmm. And so I really like, you know, Janice. She takes us places, you know, within the Panther Party that we don't know, and even her family is a really complex phenomena. You know, just the relationships, and she's got, I think, a cousin who is a physician, and he is conscious. And then she's got, you know, her uncle, and then they've got some, you know, her aunt. What's there? Is it the Aunt Ola? She's the one that's kind of different.
Yes.
Yeah.
Aunt Ola Ray. That's Uncle Boy's wife.
Right. Yeah. Talk about these people. Talk about the people that gave birth to Janice and how she's trying to find herself in the midst of all this, because there are these questions about her that she doesn't know, because, you know, she's, quote, an orphan. And so I definitely see how you could have a title of your book, Virgin Soul, because, you know, there are a lot of things about her. She does have an innocence.
These people in the book very much grew out of my being a daughter of the immigrants from the South.
Mm.
And I state that in the book, a daughter of a whole generation of people who came to the Bay Area during World War II. And they came to help out in the defense industries. After World War II, in a sense, some people have said that California wanted them to go back down south. We're through with you now. We've used you, you know. Mm-hmm. But they were here. They were firmly planted. They weren't going anywhere. And so many of them, including my own parents, lived in a set of projects. One was called Cordonesis Village, which was down at the in Gilman Street, where UC Student Housing is now, but Berkeley Farms Dairy used to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And so before that, this Cordonesis Village housing project was there, and my parents lived there for a time. And so that was a different generation that came from the South. They came from strict segregation, but we were in California. So as children, we had a different experience. I grew up in an integrated California. So some of the aims of that generation, they inculcated in us. And one of those was education, was get your education. You must get a degree. Get your education. You must be educated. Because at that time, due to the Master Plan of California and economics, education was basically free. Higher education was free. I paid $2 for a student body card at Oakland City College. That was it. I didn't have to pay anything else other than to buy my books. So when I transferred to San Francisco State, my tuition, as it is in the book, was $48 a semester. So that generation of people, young people, we were here. Many of us had either been born here or had been raised and then raised here. We were very different, in a sense, from our parents. But we had many of their same values, but we had a different kind of freedom than they had. So I think that book explores why, not I think, but, you know, Virgin Soul explores that freedom. We had the freedom to rabble-rouse, in a sense. We had education. We had time on our hands, you know.
Yeah, it's, you know, people talk a lot about the coming-of-age novel or the coming-of-age story. But, yeah, definitely pursuit of freedom is certainly a theme here. And fearlessness as well. These young people are fearless. You know,
We're fearless, but remember, we're here in California.
Mm-hmm.
Has a different reality than our parents faced in the South.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the liberties that we had and have here, our parents in no way had them in the South and would have faced severe penalties, punishment, or even death if they had done some of the things that we did as a matter of course.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And I believe that's mentioned. I think lynchings are mentioned. And Janice speaks of, you know, Freedom Rider veterans that she meets and interacts with. And when Martin King passes, you know, that's a big moment in the story.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm.
Also, to play out that dynamic a little further, it's been noted in several different places that the Oakland Police Department recruited from southern states. They go to army recruitment stations, and they would recruit southern whites to be police officers for the Oakland Police Department.
Mm-hmm.
That's noted in Panther literature. It's a fact. So one can't help but, you know, put together, you know, the idea of repression, Southern style, being imported into Oakland.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And you know, Janice talks about the differences, you know, between the communities, Oakland and San Francisco, even though San Francisco also has, you know, immigrants from different places like the South as well. She talked about them as really different kind of energy. But within that adventure, back in Oakland, speaking of police, those moments where you have those scenes that you paint with the police, you know, coming into or hearing about the police shooting up, you know, the Panther headquarters or arresting Bobby Seale or, you know, doing all these things that we know they've done. You know, the book definitely has its moments of, really intense, like we don't know what's going to happen, like when they're running, and then, you know, when Janice talks about, you know, learning how to handle a gun, and just all these questions that go through her mind about, you know, what's a revolutionary, and what kind of revolutionary is she, and then she tries to figure out what values, you know, do I want to continue to carry that are contradicted by you know, the people around me. And then she shares with us some of the contradictions. She's a real thoughtful character, an introspective character.
Yes, 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 definitely. I kind of love that moment when they go to buy some weed from a guy, mm-hmm. and she looks around his apartment once she goes in, and she observes, this is the first apartment I've been in months where there are no books.
Mm-hmm.
This is bare. This is just commerce. Is this what we're giving our lives for?
Mm-hmm.
You know, she questions at that moment if selling weed is the outcome, is worth it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And then she talks about, you know, there are laws, and, okay, we're going to break the law. Well, we have to have good reasons for it. We don't just break the law because we can, and then taking advantage of people just because we can. You know, and she talks, you know, when she's having her adolescent experience around shoplifting and doing things like that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Right, yeah, because, you know, there's certain things that she hasn't experienced because she's free now that she's a college student and living away from home, and so she has a chance to, you know, try these things that young people do as they mature and become the adults that they're going to be eventually. I was
wild, yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Getting wild.
Yeah, yeah.
It's unfortunate that with getting wild comes consequences.
Mhm. Yeah. Yeah. They certainly do. Yeah. And you have those consequences written into the tapestry of the story.
Mm.
Yeah. But she lives. You know.
Yes.
And other people live. It's not a tragedy. The story is not a tragedy. Virgin Soul is a celebration, I would say.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly, certainly. And so back to going, like, okay, how does Judy know this? I like the way you include in the book how the Panther Party had all of these allies. You know, you talk about the pastor where the free breakfast program.
Neil, wonderful, wonderful. At St. Augustine's Church, yes.
Yeah, yeah, and how the police wanted to come in, and he told them no in the book.
That happened. No, that happened in real life.
Okay.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
He was a stand-up guy.
Yeah, 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 and you talk about little Bobby Hutton and Eldridge Cleaver and some of the things he says. Like, did he really say those things that you have him saying, or is that you being creative?
No, not only did he say them, but when I sat down with the lawyers and vetted the book,
mm-hmm.
I for things like that, I had to show where it was stated somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a, do you know New West Magazine?
No, I don't know it. Mm-hmm.
Well, it came out. For, I don't know, about a decade or so, and it was a California publication.
Mm-hmm.
But there was an extensive interview with Eldridge in it, and he talked about that very bluntly, very openly.
Wow, wow. Yeah, interesting. And did you live in a Victoria with some girls, some friends from school?
Yes, yes. It's still there. It's at 47 Potomac Street, and it borders that little park that's right there.
Mm-hmm.
It was a wonderful, wonderful place. We lived in. It was a 9-room flat that we got for $197, and we still talk about it today because we just thought that was so much money at the time. We just didn't know how we were going to be able to pay our rent, and then, you know, then there were five of us, and we kind of broke it down, and we said, oh, we can do this. This is manageable.
Mm-hmm.
So it was great. It was great, and it did turn into a safe house, and it was a safe house.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, share with my audience what do you mean by safe house?
It was a place where Panthers who were on the run from the police could come and hide out for a few days, for a few weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And not be apprehended, not get caught. It was, we had enough room there, and they would bring a brother over, and he would stay there for a few days or a few weeks. Yeah,
mm-hmm. yeah. Within the book, you know, Janice, you know, talks about you know, the first time that she comes home and there are all these Black Panthers here. It's like, oh, okay, and he's staying? Like, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you didn't ask me if he could share, you know, our house with us. And then, you know, it's like, okay, so then she gets with the program and lets him stay there. But also, you know, within that, you know, she sort of analyzed, okay, her role, because some of the men didn't necessarily see the women as equals to them. They saw them more as comfort women, so to speak. And I'm talking about, you know, the comfort women that were used by the Japanese, or was it the Japanese?
Yes.
In war, you know, as concubines, unwillingly, they were raped. And so, so, you know, people know that story that women in the party and other types of organizations like that, you know, movements, are often assumed to be available sexually to the men. And I like the way you handled it in the book, and I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that, as well as the party. Did the party really happen where Kwame Ture came?
Okay, two things. Let's stick with one at a time. I'll handle both. Okay.
Well, we're in the Victorian, okay?
Yeah. Okay. So, yes, those things happen, but you have to remember the backdrop. The backdrop of the time was that there was a sexual revolution going on.
Yeah,
and that
the
had just come out. Mm-hmm. So women were very free to determine their own sexual life and their choices at that moment in history, because you didn't have to get pregnant. Abortion was made legal right at around that time. Mm-hmm. So it was a different kind of freedom. I don't think that in the party, and remember I was in it early from around 67 to 69, to 70, roughly speaking. But I got married in 68, so I was kind of out of that,
okay,
that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But my own experience was that the women were extremely feisty. We were just as feisty as any, you know, any guy, and we were fighting and we were putting our lives on the line. So it wasn't, you know, when it came up, when I was there, there was a lot of back and forth and a lot of resistance and a lot of people saying, think you want to take advantage of me? I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said in a prior interview, we used to have a saying, and the saying was, don't fall for the okey-doke.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're falling for the okey-doke. You know, and that meant, you know, somebody trying to get over on you sexually and not falling for it. But at the same time, it seems contradictory. There was a lot of sexual freedom. You know, this is remember, this was pre-herpes, pre-AIDS.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of sexual freedom. Actually, one draft of the book, one of the editors, I'll use that term, said, there's too much sex in the book.
Mm.
You know? And I just laughed and I said, were you around in the 60s, you know? You know, I mean, come on. There was plenty of sex to go around, you know, and it was very friendly, you know. But anyway, so I think that later on there were a lot of incidents, and I've actually told a friend of mine who was in later in the party, she said, she read Virgin Soul, and she said, I wanted to go on and on and on. And I said, no, you write the next one. You were there for the next phase. You write it. So there were some set-tos. There were some
heavy moments from what I heard.
Mm-hmm.
But I was in it at a different phase, at an early phase,
mm-hmm.
you know. So now you wanted to do about Stokely Carmichael?
Yeah, well, you know, there was a party. There was a party at Denise's house.
Right.
And they had been doing some audience development and doing some sort of talking about Stokely Carmichael. That was his name at that time. And he was going to be in town speaking, but they didn't expect him to come to that party afterwards.
Wanda, thank you for reading my book. My goodness.
Oh, okay.
This is great.
Oh, I loved your book.
Thank you.
I mean, for real, I really like your book. It was just, and I'm thinking about assigning it to my class, my English 1A this fall. I was just telling one of my students, like, there's sex in there. And I'm wondering, like, but it's not a whole, he said, we like sex. I'm like, okay.
Generally, people do.
yeah, and you said there was more, huh? Oh my goodness, I should be one of those.
Yeah,
those drafts. But yeah, I just think it's a great. You know, your book, and it's a novel. It reminds me of some of my favorite books. I loved Still Grazing by Hugh Masekela, because that book is about his life. But within it, you go through all of these movements, you know, mm-hmm. about mm-hmm. South Africa. You know, the development of the anti-apartheid movement, but he's a musician, so we've got these songs and his life.
Yeah.
And in another movie, another book I really like is Evolution of a Revolutionary by Jasmine Guy, Fannie Shakur, Evolution of a Revolutionary, because as you look at her life, you know, we're going through a movement. And then the one that that Kwame Ture, Thelwell finished it.
Yes, I love that, yes.
Yeah, and it's like, you get this history of, you know, the Southern Christian Leadership Council and how SNCC came about and on into, you know, the Black Power movement and then the organization that Kwame Ture started and internationally. I mean, it's like, it's just big because, you know, it starts within the diaspora because he was born, you know, outside of this country. He was born in the Caribbean, you know. And so, and then he comes here and he grows up in I think, New York. On the East Coast.
Yeah, New York.
Yeah. And so your book, that's why I think it would make a good textbook, is similar, but it's a novel. And that's why I'm like, I just thought you were just, I didn't know you had to actually, like I said, I did not put you in the book. I just thought you were just that fabulous of a writer. I'm like, wow, I got to take some notes here because she is just too good with this Janice character who is just like giving us a personal tour through this really important time in our history.
The party with Stokely Carmichael
mm-hmm.
Did occur, and
yeah.
we did have him to our apartment. At
wow.
The everything that happened in the book didn't happen that
yeah,
way.
Yeah, right.
But
mm-hmm.
the party
you met him.
It was a big deal for us to get him there, and of course the, you know, we bragged about it and we told people, Stokely Carmichael's coming to our apartment tonight, you know, deal, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a big thing. And I remember inviting a few friends from high school and they were like bowled over. They were like so impressed,
mm-hmm.
you know. So
yeah.
it was, you know, there was a little bit of, you know, we call it high side. You know, I mean, it's a little bit of fun. But I used that that incident in the novel to, you know, I expanded upon it imaginatively.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's like wow. So, did you also meet Betty Shabazz?
I can't remember.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I did.
Okay. I know the Panther Party, when they were doing security when she came in.
That telegram. Yeah. No, that scene, I was not there.
Mm-hmm.
That was all from what I read, and then I put it together and made it a scene.
Mm-hmm.
I saw her once, but I never met her.
Mm-hmm.
But I also, that telegram that's in the book is an actual artifact.
Mm.
Yeah.
Wow, wow, nice.
Yeah.
That is so awesome. Well, you want to share something else?
You mean just a little section of the...
A little section,
okay.
I really like how... you know, one thing about the Black Panther Party is the 10-point program, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
and I think that's what attracts Janice to it, because, you know, she really loves her people, and she really you know, when she starts doing her work study job, I guess, or community service, or one or the other, when she starts doing the tutoring, that's
mm-hmm.
that's a wonderful part of the book. Because we go into, you know, a community that is still having issues and still having trouble.
Yeah.
And it tells us we need to take care of our children. The children need our help. We can't forget our children.
No.
Yeah, because people sometimes, you know, when folks live in certain areas of town and, you know, it's easy for those that are doing well to not... you know, as they say, give back, you know, inquire, you know, check
yes.
in.
Yes.
Spend some resources, like time.
Article that I wrote called, which is just online just this week, called
mm-hmm.
Five Comrades Who Joined the Black Panther Party. I said that because my roommates and I joined the Black Panther Party, participated in it, and then came back to campus and got our degrees eventually at some point,
mm-hmm.
that changed us. And we weren't just going through college to get a degree and, in a sense, join a middle class where we looked down on other people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we didn't do that. Instead, we came out with a commitment to being fighters for people's rights and for our communities. One of my roommates said that she would not have remained close to Hunters Point Bayview if she hadn't gone through that experience.
Mm.
You know, but she ran a school there for many years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So it was that kind of commitment that came out of that, and I think that came out for a whole generation of people, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Where is your article published?
It's called The Weaklings. It's an essay a day magazine online.
Oh, nice. Weaklings.
And if people look up five, you can find it under Five Comrades.
Okay.
And Judy Juanita, they'll find it if they just look up those words, Google those words, Five Comrades, Judy Juanita, it's in there.
Okay, thanks.
I liked the fluidity, this is chapter 44.
Mm-hmm.
I liked the fluidity of the revolution. Yeah, baby, yeah, burn, baby, burn. Reading ecstatic poetry as an opening and closing act for Leroy Jones, up and down the peninsula, arousing cheers and fears. It caught up with me. I flunked two classes at State, running with the Panthers and being a little star. I applied to Cal State Hayward for the summer to pull my GPA up to snuff, a common strategy among State students. Leanne said nobody's irreplaceable, and sure enough, another sister from L.A. came in to help with the BPP newspaper. My roomies used my VW to do revolutionary work, while a friend from social psychology hooked me up with her ride from the city to Hayward. Cal State was different from State. Modern, new, spacious, empty, devoid. Was it too hot to take classes? I became an anthropological specimen. Sisters wore their hair cascading onto their shoulders. Black Barbies. My kinky hair was confrontation. Just walking to class, minding my own, I stirred things up. They looked at me, smiled weakly. One person was halfway hip. This guy, Drummond, was president of the Black student group. Call me Drum. I wanted to tell him, I'm already there, square. But he wasn't square, just bougie.
conceited, full of it. We met in the hall between the buildings by the pool. Yeah, we real cool. We meet at the pool. That's how black we were. That's where we lay. That's where he laid down his heaviest wrap. Me in my swimsuit with the foam rubber cups. Him with his stuff hanging out anthropologically. We met surrounded by white folks swimming and sunning. The rest of the world in a snit over Vietnam. San Francisco and the long hot summer of urban riot fears a world away. Drum said, let me take you to the beach. We could get down and around. Take me to the beach. Not let's go. Let me take you. Are you a camel with humps? Let's play hooky, he said. I knew this was about Nookie. He touched my hair, fascinated by a natural woman. He said the biggest turn-on was seeing me float on my back with no cap on like a white girl. What did this dude want? Yeah, man, got down with the queen, made her holler and scream. He wouldn't know my name if I plastered it on my forehead. I drew my leg to my chest, extended it to the sky. I was an aquanet. His rap sounded light in the sun like margarine for butter.
Yeah, that's a funny moment.
Yeah.
I don't know if Cal State East Bay has changed much.
I hope it has, but I don't know.
Yeah, wow. Well, this is a wonderful journey that you have shared with us in your novel, Virgin Soul. Looking for other novels, other things to read. When did you actually finish the book? And are you working on another one?
I finished this probably about 2.5 years ago.
Oh, okay. So you've got another book.
Actually, I finished a second one in December. So we'll see what happens. Nobody's interested in a second novel if the first one doesn't go anywhere. So.
Well, we certainly have to have it go somewhere.
I hope so. I just hope so. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Wow. So I guess you can't talk about it because it's not published, right?
I don't want to talk about it yet, but it's totally different from this.
Wow. Well, this book here is just so wonderful, and I really enjoyed it. And I enjoy your writing, period, but this Virgin Soul was just so nice. So such a wonderful journey, and congratulations.
Thank you, Wanda. Hmm? I appreciate your questions and your thorough reading of the book, and that's such a compliment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know, it's great writing.
Thanks.
Your book, Virgin Soul, is going to be around. It's going to be one of those ones that we are reading in centuries and years to come when people want to know about this time.
Yeah,
They're going to pick up these kind of books. Virgin Soul is certainly in there.
I did write it as a document for the future.
Because this is important with, you know, the Janice's journey and the experiences that she has in your book. You know, this is really important, and because it's so anchored in the truth of the moments, you know, even those fictional moments, they're still anchored in the truth of that moment, and she is so authentic and so well-rounded and so believable that, people are going to be, you know, quoting her, thinking about, what would Janice do? Just like she thinks to herself, you know, what would so-and-so do? Yeah.
So, totally a character in a book.
Yeah.
There was no way I was that introspective at 19 and 20.
Yeah, well, girls are orphans. She's got some things she had to, you know, she's a little bit more, she's more of an old soul.
Yeah.
Because of, you know, her life and sort of not feeling like she was there all that time. You know, she felt kind of invisible.
Right.
You know, in her family, even though, you know, she wasn't, but she didn't have, you know, a mother and a father, and all kids want a mother and a father, and she didn't know the story. She didn't know why her father wasn't there. So, you know, it's kind of hard, but she makes it.
Right.
Yeah. So folks can catch you at Books, Inc., your first reading, 7 o'clock in Alameda, Friday night, April 19th.
Yes.
Yeah, so be there or be square.
Okay, thank you. And coming up on May 1st at Moe's with Ishmael Reed.
Oh, Ishmael's he's going to be there with you.
Yes, yes.
Oh, is he going to be reading from your book or his own book?
No, he's going to read some of his work.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, yeah, and then we'll have, and I'll read from Virgin Soul, and then we'll have a discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And then on May 4th, we'll be at, I'll be at the book signing at the 57th Street Gallery.
Yeah, that's going to really be nice. And you'll be at Book Passage on May 2nd. But the 57th Street Gallery, the 2 p.m. with the panel, that's going to be really special.
Right.
Yeah, so people need to just make it a Virgin Soul tour. Just follow you around.
Good, good.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I think there's like...
And buy the book. Buy the book, yes.
Oh, of course. Buy several.
Passage is Thursday, May 2nd.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
At PM at the Ferry Building.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, people can buy copies of the book and give them away as Juneteenth presents.
A wonderful idea. Wonderful idea.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Wanda?
Oh, you're welcome. It's been lovely speaking to you. And again, congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right. Peace and blessings.
And thank you for all of the work, I mean work, that you do promoting culture and education in the Bay Area. It's just a wonderful, wonderful thing. Portia and I, you know, I'm good friends with Portia, and we're always marveling at your energy.
Well, thank you so much.
Thanks.
All right, you take good care.
Okay.
Peace and blessings. Bye-bye. Well, once again, that was author Judy Juanita speaking about her novel, Virgin Soul. And, again, you can catch it tonight in Alameda. Her poetry and fiction has been published widely, and her plays have been produced in the Bay Area and New York City. A native Californian, she lived for nearly two decades in New Jersey, where she worked as a poet in the schools and as a reporter for The Record. That's the name of the news organ there. She was awarded New Jersey Arts Council Fellowship of Poetry and an MFA in Creative Writing from San Francisco State University, which we already talked about. She has taught writing at Laney College in Oakland since 1993, which means you could take her class. And Virgin Soul, I can't say enough about it. It's a really wonderful, wonderful first novel, and looking for more to come. And sort of celebrating the revolution, which means change, right? I'm going to play Archie Shepp's piece by the same title. And looking forward to having you tune in for another edition of Wanda's Picks on Wednesday at 6 a.m. Peace and blessings.
My grandmother was born during the time of slavery. That was a time when black people didn't have saxophones. They didn't have trombones or trumpets. They didn't even have drums. All they had was their bodies. Their bodies. Sometimes the jaw bones of animals, pots and pans. There's a song she taught me that the slaves used to sing. Up in Harlem, they're talking they want to change. And down in Philadelphia, they're walking. They want to change. I I went to San Francisco, baby. Down in Baghdad, now that the war has begun, thank you. I told her like this. I said, hey, we are the victims. You know what I'm going to tell my son? That death cloaks the Potomac in a scarlet shawl. And the pillow beneath you is not here. But honey, I want you to take this ex-cannibal's kiss and turn it into a revolution.
Mama.